Thank you very much, John, for your overly generous introduction. It is really exciting to be here, where I have the pleasure of associating with scholars who have done leading work in happiness, John being one of them, Andrew Oswald, another, Jan Deneuve, Nick Powderby, my former student, Anka Planiel. All of them are here, and it's so nice to be with them and to have the benefit of the expertise of leading scholars in the field of development and China. My talk today will focus on three questions. The first question is, has the transition from socialism to capitalism improved people's feelings of subjective well-being in China and Eastern Europe? There's a lot of work on the transition. What institutions would foster more rapid economic growth in the transition countries? Very little work has gone to the trouble of asking, well, how do conditions compare in the transition countries now with those that prevailed before under socialism? The issue of how people's feelings of well-being have changed is, of course, of fundamental importance. And most economists would, I think, automatically assume that the feelings have improved dramatically as a result of the transition to the free market, economists being somewhat prone to think highly of the free market. My second question is about economic growth. Does economic growth in itself improve people's feelings of well-being? And my third question is, are there other policies besides economic growth that might improve people's feelings of well-being? Am I blocking your view over here? Because I can shift over a little bit. And in answering these questions, my approach is simply to say, well, what does the evidence have to tell us about these particular questions? I'll use a few abbreviations as I go along, so I'm putting them down ahead of time. TCs is transition countries, DCs is developed countries, LDCs, less developed countries. SWB is subjective well-being, a blanket term for happiness and life satisfaction, and SES for socioeconomic status. So let me start, before we can get into the questions, to be clear on what we mean by subjective well-being. It's the responses in a nationally representative survey to several types of questions. Okay. One question is how you would rate your happiness. Another is how you would rate your satisfaction with life. And a third, as your standing, how you would rate your standing on a best-worst scale of life satisfaction. Here are the specific questions. Happiness, this is from the U.S. General Social Survey, conducted since 1972. Taken all together, how would you say things are these days? Would you say that you are very happy, pretty happy, or not too happy? And that's coded 3-2-1. The life satisfaction question is from the World Values Survey, conducted since about 1981. All things considered, how satisfied are you with your life as a whole these days? Please use this card to help with your answer. And there's a scale from 1 to 10. And people give an integer response to that question. The ladder of life question is much lengthier basically, as you can see, it says, imagine, here's a ladder, 10 is the best of all possible worlds, 0 is the worst of possible worlds. Where on the scale of 0 to 10 do you stand? These are what are called evaluative questions about subjective well-being. They're asking people to rate their lives in general. The immediate question comes up in anybody's mind that hasn't been acquainted with work in the field, whether these measures are meaningful. So one response is to appeal to authority, all right? French President Sarkozy set up a commission back around 2008, being dissatisfied with the total reliance that prevailed on GDP per capita, real GDP per capita, as a measure of well-being. And so he set up this commission comprised of 25 people, of which Andrew Oswald was one of the members. 22 were economists. There were 5 Nobel Prize winners. These were people from my generation or somewhat younger, but schooled in the view that economists never paid any attention to anything people said. They only paid attention to what they do, how they behave. This commission made early in its executive summary the following statement. Research has shown that it is possible to collect meaningful and reliable data on subjective as well as objective well-being. And then they go on to recommend that there should be official collections of data of this sort. And now 9 countries are embarked on the collection of happiness data. An alternative approach, instead of appealing to authority, is to appeal to reason, okay? And so an alternative answer to this question, or a complementary answer, is that yes, these subjective well-being measures are meaningful because when people are asked what makes them happy, it turns out people in countries throughout the world, poor, rich, capitalist, communist, they tend to say the same sorts of things are important for their happiness. Here's the results of a survey done by Hadley Cantrell, a social psychologist, back in the early 1960s. It covered 12 countries. And in this survey, interviewers went to a respondent and they asked the respondent a simple open-ended type of question. Tell me what for you would be the best of all possible worlds, and then what would be the worst of all possible worlds. And then they were asked where, they were given the ladder type of thing, where they would put themselves on this ladder. So he then took their responses, which had to do with things like, oh, my child is sick and coughing, and I would like that child to get better, or in India, people would say, well, I would really very much like to have a fan. This was in the 1960s, understand? So these were the, and in the United States, they would say, well, I want to send my child to private school or learn how to play golf, you see. But he then took these and categorized them according to whether the people were talking about their living conditions, their level of living, their family life, their health, their work, the world's situation, questions of discrimination, social justice, and so on. And the results he got were of the following sort. The concerns are listed here in the rank order of the results he got. What I have done is take the concern that was most highly rated in each country, and that's listed on the left, and then the concern's lowest rank, okay? So as you can see, statements about living level were always number one in every single one of the 12 countries. The lowest rank was one, the highest rank was one. Statements about family life ranked number two on the highest, and in some countries they were number three. Health, number two, some countries as low as number six. Work, 3 and 6. Character, 4 and 6. Those five items were among those named most prominently in virtually every country. What was rarely named were things having to do with social equity, international relations, domestic politics, or people who just cared about the status quo. Here you can see the percentage, the highest percentage in a country and the lowest percentage. So, for example, column 3 with 95 at the top means that there was a country in which 95% of the respondents named living conditions as a concern. The country that named them least of all, 60% of the people named living conditions as their principal concern. And in that country, that was the highest ranking concern. And so you can see the highest percentage ranges from 95 down to 42%. Let me move over here so everybody can see. And then there's a sharp break with other concerns coming up much less frequently mentioned. Now, you may well ask, why is it that all these things end up being so important to people everywhere? And it doesn't take a great deal of genius to say, well, when you think about how people spend their lives everywhere, it's trying to make a living, worrying about a family, trying to find the kind of work that they enjoy, worrying about health. These are the things that are the fundamental concerns of most people in most places throughout the world. And that's why I would argue responses on subjective well-being are meaningful, because what we are finding is what for most people everywhere is largely determining their happiness. The same things are important. So my conclusion is, yes, the concerns that are foremost in people's minds that principally underlie reports of subjective well-being are the same everywhere, and their living conditions, family, health, and work. And these are the concerns that take up most people's time and which they think they have some ability to control. So comparisons of SWB are meaningful because for most people, happiness depends on the same things. That doesn't mean you can compare it on an individual basis, one-to-one, but when we're talking about groups of people, they have in common pretty much the same concerns. On to the questions. Number one, has the transition from socialism to capitalism increased subjective well-being in Eastern Europe and China? And the answer is no. So I'll present the evidence to you. In talking about the transition countries, there's an issue of selection. The choice is governed by the need to have an initial observation prior to or shortly after the start of the transition. That is, when we still have a glimpse of how people were feeling under socialism. In the case of China, where the data are primarily for the urban sector, we can do this for 1990 to 2010. In the case of Russia, 1981 to 2005, although for Russia as a whole, the data start in 1990, but we have data for segments that are relevant to Russia earlier. East Germany starts in 1990, but we can use data for Hungary to get some sense of the earlier period. So the data sources, for China, I'm using two. Actually, there are six sources that I use in writing about this. But Horizon is the Gallup poll of China. It's a Chinese organization that's conducted surveys going back into the late 1990s. The World Value Survey is the principal one covering long periods. And for East Germany, we have the German Socioeconomic Panel, which happily started in 1990, just before unification. Here's the growth of output in these three countries since 1990. It differs quite markedly. In East Germany and Russia, you can see that it drops dramatically. In Russia, close to 50% decline by the mid-90s. In East Germany, a sharp drop, but then recovery fairly rapidly as West Germany buffered the economy. And in China, we have this enormous rate of economic growth, the highest on record. GDP per capita doubled in 10 years and redoubled in the next 10 years. So there's a fourfold growth in real GDP per capita in China over this 20-year period. That rate of growth, I would think most people would say, should be enough to leave the people dancing in the streets. But what has happened to satisfaction in China? Here we have the mean life satisfaction according to two series, the World Value Survey going back to 1990 and ending around 2007, the Horizon data going back to about 1997, if I recall, and coming down to the present. And as you can see, they tend to show a decline and return with a return somewhat short of the initial value. Here's the picture for Russia. Again, we get a decline in return, a much greater decline. And now in the case of Russia, we can extend it back with Tambov and Oblast about, I think about 100 miles south of Moscow. Tambov is selected by some Russian statisticians at that time as representative of the country as a whole, though it only has like a million population. But in 1995, they did a survey both in Russia as a whole and in Tambov. And as you can see, as you can see, if I can get this pointer with it, right here, Tambov and Russia in 1995 are very close. So the argument is Tambov is probably reasonably representative of Russia back in the early period, and Belarus, of course, which was part of the Soviet Union, also has a similar value to Tambov and comes extremely close to Russia in the overlap period. So the argument is, this is Russia in 88, already considerably above their 1990 value, but even earlier, still higher. So you get this remarkable U-shaped picture in Russia. Again, with the, bear with me, folks. Again, with the, the most recent value for Russia below those early values. Here's East Germany. It starts in 1990, and you can see the decline and then recovery, but never much different from the initial level. If we assume that Hungary, where we have a 1982 survey, may be indicative of how East Germany was earlier on, because Hungary is very close to East Germany around 1990, you can see Hungary is close to the 7 level that was true of Russia and also of China. So in all three countries, you have a picture that shows a decline and recovery, with the recovery being somewhat short of the initial value. So despite different trajectories of GDP per capita, life satisfaction has followed a U-shaped pattern in all three transition countries. The most recent life satisfaction value tends to be below the pre-transition value. Now, it's easy to misread what's happened to the transition, and this is why an early observation of life satisfaction is so important. Here we have the picture for Slovenia, where the first life satisfaction observation is in 1992. And if you just start with the first life satisfaction point, you see life satisfaction rising and GDP rising. But it turns out, with no early life satisfaction observation, the collapse of life satisfaction is missed. So here's the picture when you put in GDP for the period before 1992, and you see the U-shaped pattern for GDP that was also true in East Germany and Russia, and how if you don't have an earlier observation, you're led to misread the relationship, to assume that in the transition, what happened was, they started low and life satisfaction went up along with GDP. Whereas when you have observations that go back into that pre-transition period, you're led to a quite different conclusion. Namely, they were pretty high to start with, they went down, and have recovered not to a level as high as they originally were. It's of interest to look at what's happened to life satisfaction by socioeconomic status. So here we have the life satisfaction observations for three income groups in the population. We've divided the population into the upper income group, middle, and lower income group. And as you can see, in China, in 1990, all three groups were very close together. The measure here is the percent responding 7 to 10 on the 1 to 10 scale of the World Value Survey of Life Satisfaction. This is the measure that Ronald Engelhardt uses, and I just followed his approach. And you can see what happens by the end of the period. Life satisfaction of the lowest segment of the population has gone down, and for the middle, it's gone down slightly, and for the upper, trended hardly at all. That's China. Here's the self-reported health by socioeconomic status in China. In the upper group, it's improved over this period. In the middle group, no change. And the lower group, deteriorated. Here's their financial satisfaction. Looks much like the health picture. Better for the upper group, stable for the middle group, worse for the lower group. The lowest group has come up worse on all three measures in China. Here's Russia. Here we see the upper group rising more rapidly than the lower group on life satisfaction, but a slight increase for the lower group. But that's because for Russia, the SES data start in 1990. After Russia has already been declining. And indeed, between 1990 and 2006, I think it is, or seven, life satisfaction overall improves in Russia. You're not getting a picture that corresponds to that overall movement. So the argument is, because you start late with the SES data in Russia, you get a picture of improvement in life satisfaction across all three groups, but the lowest group improving least of all. Here for Russia is self-reported health, and you see the upper group improving, the middle group improving, no change for the lower group. Here's financial satisfaction, little change for the upper, declines for both the middle and lower. So, the picture for Russia is essentially consistent with that for China. Here's East Germany, life satisfaction improving for the upper slightly, declining for the lower in the transition. So our conclusion is overall for the transition countries, Despite different trajectories of GDP per capita, life satisfaction has followed a U-shaped pattern in all three. The most recent life satisfaction value tends to be below the pre-transition value with no long-term increase. And the most disadvantaged segment of the population has suffered the most in the transition. So why? Why this remarkable pattern of decline and limited recovery and life satisfaction in these three countries, which I think are representative of the transition experience generally? The first point to note is how high they are to start with. 7.29 for China, Russia, almost exactly the same value for this Tambov Oblast, 7.26. Now, it's of some relevance to note that China's economic policies under communism were modeled on those of Russia and that they had Russian advisors. So there was a very great similarity in the two countries in the kinds of wage structures that existed. Hungary, almost at a level of 7 back in 1982. For a long time, I had a hard time accepting the Chinese value, given how low incomes were in China in 1990. But eventually, I had to come to the conclusion the reasons for their high initial levels of life satisfaction were that they had full employment and a comprehensive social safety net. And here are the observations that, among others, led me to this conclusion. The first is from the book by Knight and Song. It was like an epiphany for me when I read this passage from this book about conditions in China. Here, I couldn't believe they could be so good and so high in life satisfaction in 1990. But John Knight says, job rights have until very recently been firmly entrenched in urban China. State-owned enterprises have supplied extensive welfare benefits, including housing, medical services, pensions, childcare, and jobs for grown children. Almost all state employees and many in the larger collectives have thus enjoyed an iron rice bowl. Lifetime tenure of their job and a relatively high wage in the enterprise representing a mini welfare state. Here's a quotation from two other economists, quite highly respected in the United States, Elizabeth Brainerd and David Cutler. David Cutler is, I think, still currently dean of College of Liberal Arts in the United States, at Harvard University. Before 1989, Russians lived in a country that provided economic security. Unemployment was virtually unknown. Pensions were guaranteed and provided a standard of living perceived to be adequate, and macroeconomic instability did not much affect the average citizen. Here's East Germany, the former GDR. Another quotation from a scholar of the East German situation. Over the 40 years of existence, the DDR, East Germany, has developed as a completely different state from West Germany. There was no unemployment, no open inflation, low work intensity, free medical services, low prices for housing and public transport. That was the initial circumstances connected with the high life satisfaction. The effects of the transition were unemployment increases substantially and safety net benefits, which are employer provided in these countries, decrease as the workers lose their jobs, as they shift to private employers, and as state enterprises are restructured. Together, one and two lead to a negative effect on subjective well-being. Here's evidence in terms of the unemployment rate. We start in 1990 at full employment in all three countries. It rises to double-digit levels in all three countries, and in all three countries has since improved moderately. In a sense, these are rough mirror images of what's happening with life satisfaction. Life satisfaction is going down and recovering, but not fully. Unemployment is going up and then recovering, but not fully. In terms of evidence for the safety net, there's a lot of piecemeal evidence for China and Russia, but the best evidence is for East Germany, where we actually have questions in the GSOEP, not only about overall life satisfaction, but satisfaction with various domains of life, particular areas of life. So they ask about the satisfaction of people with their environment, the availability of goods, dwelling, standard of living, and household income. And in all of these, there are improvements that take place between 1990 and 2004 when we have fairly comparable data. What's notable is the responses in 1990, our environment and goods availability, are among the lowest responses you'll find on satisfaction questions, as low as three. And all observers of East Germany were commenting continually about the terrible smog conditions that prevailed, environmental pollution, and also how there were no goods available on the shelves. And these ratings of life satisfaction testify to the accuracy of those observers' comments. They also testify to the reliability of the satisfaction data. That this is still before unification with West Germany, but the people are telling you, as far as the environment and goods availability are concerned, it's terrible. Those are the positive changes. The negative changes are the ones that involve the safety net. Health, with they had under socialism assurance of health care, work, assurance of a job, child care was taken care of. In all three of these domains, there are sizable declines in people's satisfaction over this period. The negative changes reflect the retreat from full employment and safety net policies and growing concerns about jobs and social support. Overall, life satisfaction in East Germany in this period is virtually unchanged, the negative changes outweighing the effect of the positive changes. So the conclusion on question one, has the transition to market capitalism increased subjective well-being in Eastern Europe and China? The answer is no. Subjective well-being declined and then recovered to a level short of pre-transition values, with the poor suffering most. Why? Unemployment increased substantially and the social safety net collapsed. On to question two. Question two is, will economic growth in itself raise subjective well-being? Is the experience of China an exception? China being a case where you have this enormous increase in GDP per capita and no reflection of that in the life satisfaction data. No reflection that it in any way dominated the life satisfaction data. And the answer to question two, to anticipate it, since I know you're on the edge of your seats, the evidence is that over the long term, more rapid economic growth has no effect on subjective well-being. There is, however, a positive short-term relationship between growth and subjective well-being, which is often mistaken for the long-term relationship. So here's an illustration of what I'm talking about with regard to the long-term and the short-term. Okay, the short-term are the fluctuations in GDP and happiness, GDP going up and down and happiness going up and down, and they're going up together. They're positively related. On the other hand, the long-term trend, the broken lines, are not related. GDP goes up, subjective well-being stays the same, okay? It's like a woman goes to the doctor and she says, "Doctor, I'm doing so well, I've been losing my weight." And he says, "Yeah, But look what happens to the trend in your weight, okay? The trend is not the same as the fluctuations. So what is the evidence for the nil long-term relationship? And the answer is countries with higher rates of economic growth do not have more rapid growth in subjective well-being. I'm using here the same approach as two of my critics, Stevenson and Wolfers, and Sachs, Stevenson and Wolfers, except that in my analysis, I use the longest period of observation of subjective well-being for each country, whereas they use shorter periods. For example, they totally omit data from Wave 5 of the World Values Survey. Those data have been available since 2008. Their latest article, published in 2012, still does not use Wave 5 of the World Values Survey. They choose, I think intentionally, shorter periods over longer periods. I choose longer periods intentionally over shorter periods. So here's what you would expect if growth was raising subjective well-being, okay? On the horizontal axis, we have the growth rate of GDP per capita. Here's a country A with 2% growth rate, country B with 4% growth rate. So the expected change in subjective well-being would be less than for in A than for B. Okay, we expect a positive relationship between the growth rate of subjective well-being and the growth rate of GDP per capita. Here's the actual. This is for 17 developed countries with time spans ranging in a minimum from 21 years up to 34 years. As you can see, the growth rates range from 1 up to about 4.5%. No evidence of a trend. If we throw out Luxembourg and Ireland, the same is true. There's no trend in these data. There's no significant indication that higher growth is associated with a greater improvement in well-being. That's developed countries. Here's the transition countries for which we can get pre-transition observations, so are pretty close to the beginning of the transition. In this case, they're for 12 to 22 years, and you can see the same pattern. The growth rates range in GDP per capita from -1 to about 3%. No evidence that countries with higher growth rates are having a greater improvement in life satisfaction. Here's the 9 developing countries for which we could get from the World Value Survey fairly long coverage. You see here we have a much wider range of growth rates from around 0 in South Africa up to China's enormous growth rate, but Korea and Japan are way up around 6%. This is Chile. So again, no evidence that even these very high rates of economic growth are associated with any greater improvement in life satisfaction. We can throw all these countries together, the DCs, the TCs, and the LDCs. So now we have about 37 countries, and the picture is the same. If you drop out China, it's still the same. No evidence that you have any positive relationship between the rate of economic growth and the improvement in subjective well-being. Here's an entirely different body of data, which is dismissed by Wolfers as no good, without any explanation of why he thinks it's no good. We worked pretty hard to make these data as comparable as possible. We used financial satisfaction, which you would think would be even more related to economic growth than life satisfaction, but we used financial satisfaction because that was the question and response categories where they were the same continually over the period we're looking at. And here you see for these 17 Latin American countries, the same picture we've seen from the World Value Survey. Again, no evidence that countries with higher growth rates are enjoying any greater improvement in life satisfaction than countries with lower growth rates. So our conclusion, graphically, this is what we expected, and that's what we get. No relationship, not a positive relationship. Verbally, is economic growth leading to greater subjective well-being? No, the evidence for a variety of countries, developed transition and less developed, is the more rapid economic growth does not lead to greater improvement in subjective well-being. China is not an exception. Let's look at the short term, though, okay? Here's where we expect a positive relationship. The growth, economic growth and happiness will move up and down together over time. Is this true in developed countries? Well, the answer is yes. For the European developed countries, Dutella, McCulloch, and Oswald in 2001 presented published a very nice paper demonstrating the positive association between growth, economic growth, and GDP, economic growth and happiness in the short run. I've put up here a graph from my friends Stevenson and Wolfers, okay, for the United States, showing how over the short term, output and life satisfaction have gone up and down. So Stevenson and Wolfers are well aware that in the short term, there is this positive relationship. They demonstrate it nicely. Their data end here around 2005, so they missed the Great Recession. I'm sure all of you want to know what's happened to happiness in the United States during the Great Recession. This is from the General Social Survey, and you can see here's the trend up to 2005, about when Stevenson Wolfers end, and here's what's happened to happiness in the Great Recession. The lowest value observed in the period since, it's 40 years about, of data collection on happiness in the United States. Well, since I'm here at Oxford, I can't bypass the fact that Angus Deaton gave the Hicks Lecture here in 2011, and he presented very nice evidence of a different type, not my evidence, about the impact of the financial crisis on subjective well-being, consistent with this. The only puzzling thing about Deaton's presentation is he somehow thinks this contradicts the Easterlin paradox, you see. The Easterlin paradox is nicely demonstrated by the trend line here. No improvement in happiness over the long term. In the short term, of course, ups and downs, and that's what Deaton demonstrates, as I'm demonstrating here, but it doesn't contradict the long-term trend. His statement is an example of how people draw upon results from looking at the short term to assert that they contradict the long term when, in fact, that's simply not the case. Well, that was the developed countries. Here's the transition countries. This you've already seen. Life satisfaction, in this case GDP, going up and down together. This is East Germany. This is Estonia. This is the Russian Federation. The timing here is the same because these are annual observations on life satisfaction. Here we only have intermittent observations on life satisfaction, so the timing is not quite the same because we have annual data on GDP. If I just use the GDP data for the points that we have life satisfaction observations, it looks like this. GDP and life satisfaction going up and down together in these countries in the short term. Here's my Latino barometer data. One of the neat things is they are annual data, and there are very few annual data series on life satisfaction for developing countries. This is in the period 1994 to 2006. Here's the general pattern of GDP. It's the mean for all 17 countries, but because it turns out all 17 countries are moving almost synchronously in Latin America. It's really unbelievable how similar they are. They may differ by a year or two, one way or the other, but basically all have the same pattern of GDP hitting a trough right here around 2002 and then recovering. And when we add the financial satisfaction series, it fluctuates more, but you can see it's coming down here, hitting the trough in 2002 and recovering. So the picture is, in the short term, whether it's developed countries, transition countries, LDCs, happiness and life satisfaction are going together, although in the long term, the trends, the broken lines are different. And so the confusion, it's easy to say, as Angus Deaton did, well, the short-term pattern and the contraction or the expansion is contradicting the long-term, which, of course, it's not. So let me go back to my friends now, Sack, Stevenson, and Wolfers in 2012. This is the data they use in talking about how there's a positive relationship in the long term between life satisfaction and GDP. And they'd use these data from wave two to wave four for Russia. And they show a decline in life satisfaction and show a decline in GDP. If, however, they'd bothered to put wave five into the picture, they would have found that, you know, it's a U-shaped pattern with no change in of any significance in either of these data. So this is an example of how if you use the short term, you'll observe the short term relationship, but not the long term relationship. Here's my Slovenia case. They use the Slovenia data. I do not use Slovenia for the very reason that when you look at GDP per capita, you see you don't have an observation for the period when GDP is deteriorating. You don't have an observation for life satisfaction. But that doesn't keep SSW from using the Slovenia data. Finally, one final example of how they're using short-term, not long-term data, and when they generalize about the long-term. This is back to the developed countries. Here's the picture I showed you. And now it's Ireland that I'm interested in up here, where we have those data are for 75 to 2007. So over that 32-year period, Ireland shows a growth rate on the order of 4% and no change in life satisfaction, significantly different from countries with much lesser growth rates, okay? What do Stevenson and Wolfers do? They replace the full period by three sub-periods. So what they do is get these 3 points that are blinking now, okay? And of course, if you connect those points with a line, you can see how by using shorter periods, they're replacing the longer term relationship by the shorter term positive relationship. They do this for all their countries. They come up with a correlation, a regression coefficient that is significant at the 0.29 level, I think, and not exactly persuasive. So, does economic growth lead to greater subjective well-being? The conclusion is no. Data covering long periods show a nil relationship, but analysts using short-term data misread the short-term positive relationship for the long-term nil relationship. And that brings us to question three. It gets shorter as we go along, folks. Are there other policies that might raise subjective well-being? Well, we've already seen that the experience of the transition countries suggests that full employment and safety net policies are important for happiness. In those countries, the abandonment of those policies led to a deterioration in life satisfaction. So the issue is there other evidence consistent with the experience of the transition countries? And first, there's evidence in the happiness literature. Second, subjective well-being differences among European welfare states. And third, Costa Rica. So first, the happiness literature. Well, here's my friend Andrew Oswald again with Blanche Flower. An increase in the unemployment rate has a significant negative effect on subjective well-being. And the effect is observed among the employed as well as the unemployed. In other words, when things get bad, the employed people start worrying about their jobs and they're suffering, their life satisfaction is suffering too. And the policy implication as well, Full employment makes for higher subjective well-being. Unemployment makes for lower subjective well-being. That's the full employment. Here's an indication from the literature on the importance of the safety net. Again, a different article by Dattel, McCulloch, and Oswald. In this case, it has to do with the benefit rate for those who become unemployed. They looked at the relationship between the benefit rate and life satisfaction and concluded the unemployment benefit replacement rate is positively correlated with happiness levels and is well defined statistically. In other words, the more unemployment benefits replace people's previous earnings while employed, the happier the unemployed people tended to be. In the political science literature, there's a fair amount of evidence similar to this about how the safety net contributes to subjective well-being. And the policy implication is safety net policies are important for people's subjective well-being. That's the findings in the literature. For other evidence, what I do is compare European countries with the same GDP per capita but different welfare policies and ask, are there any differences in subjective well-being? So I've grouped Denmark, Sweden, and Finland together as ultra-welfare states and semi-welfare states, France, the UK, Germany, and Austria. And here's their macroeconomic conditions in 2007. Their GDP per capita is very similar. It's also similar within the groups, but virtually identical between the groups. The inflation rate is the same, and the unemployment rate is almost the same. So the basic conclusion is very similar economic conditions in these two groups of countries. What about their policies with regard to people's subjective well-being? So I'm going to use this generosity index that's constructed by Lyle Scruggs, a political scientist at Connecticut, University of Connecticut. Who based his work on Esping Anderson's Three Worlds of Capitalism. As a check on it, I compare what he says about the generosity of unemployment benefits in these two groups of countries with the income replacement rate of the OECD. Here's the OECD, which shows a higher average income replacement rate in the ultra-welfare states. Scruggs index includes not just the replacement rate, but the scope of the people who are eligible for unemployment and also the duration of unemployment benefits. So his index is more comprehensive, but it shows a pattern very similar to the OECD one. So here's his indexes not only for unemployment, which we've just seen, but for sickness, better in the ultra-welfare states, and for pensions. He adds these three up and comes up with an overall benefit rate. And the consistent conclusion across this set of policies is the ultra-welfare states are more generous than those of the semi-welfare states in regard to their public policies. Are the policy differences reflected in the attitudes of the public? Economists don't look much at attitudinal data, though they're starting to do more on this. But the question is, you know, sure, you can show that the policies are more generous in the ultra-welfare states and the economic conditions are the same as in the other group. But is there any evidence that people, you know, are attuned to these policies? So in this 2007 survey, people were asked, how would you rate the quality of each of the following public services, okay? And as regards health, in the ultra-welfare states, they rate public services higher. As regards education, they rate the ultra-welfare states higher. As regards care of children and the elderly, the ultra-welfare states are higher. And as far as public pensions are concerned, the ultra-welfare states are higher. So there's a very consistent picture that people are attuned to the difference in policies in these two sets of countries. And so the question is, well, they reflected in people's feelings of satisfaction. So here we have a question on, tell me on a scale of 1 to 10, how satisfied you are with each of the following items, where 1 means very dissatisfied and 10 means very satisfied. Your work, people are more satisfied in the ultra welfare state. Your health, more satisfied in the ultra. Family life, more satisfied in the ultra. And finally, the big overall measure, life satisfaction, greater in the ultra welfare states than in the semi-welfare states. So the conclusion from the comparison of welfare states is that although they have similar macroeconomic conditions, subjective well-being is higher in the set of countries where public policies regarding work, health, and family are more generous and more comprehensive. This result is consistent with the findings in the literature and also with the experience of the transition countries where adverse changes in employment and safety net reduced happiness. And finally, I want to present as evidence of the importance of public policies, Costa Rica, whose life satisfaction is highest in the world, according to the Gallup World Poll Survey 2007 to 2010. Now, they also do lateral life, and although Costa Rica is very high, it's not first. But on life satisfaction, it actually comes out first. GDP per capita in Costa Rica is 1/4 of that in the United States. What about its policies? I'd love to have these quotations, okay? This is from a book by a historian who particularly worked on life expectancy. James Riley at the University of Indiana, Low Income, Social Growth, and Good Health. He says in his study of Costa Rica, the best known elements in Costa Rica's social development were introduced in the 1940s in the form of social insurance and pensions and the formation of a welfare or benefactor state. But the institutions of social development, schools and general population literacy, healthcare, and a population armed with information that helped protect themselves from health risks had been built in the 1890s. So Costa Rica has this incredible history of public policies in the interest of the health, the education, and the welfare of the population. The conclusion is for Costa Rica, although Costa Rica's GDP per capita is low, its policies have led to high life satisfaction. Our conclusion on policy and subjective well-being, yes, employment and safety net policies increase happiness. The evidence is the experience of the transition countries, the literature on subjective well-being, the comparison of European welfare states, and Costa Rica, where a high subjective well-being exists despite low GDP per capita. And so that brings us to back where we started, the question and answers. As the transition from subjective from socialism to capitalism increased subjective well-being in China and Eastern Europe? The answer is no. Does economic growth in itself raise people's feelings of well-being? The answer is no. Are there other policies that might raise subjective well-being? And the answer is yes. Employment and safety net policies. And I can't resist a little epilogue here, okay? This is the concluding passage from a book by a popular writer in China, John Bing, The Diary of Government Official Ho Weidong. Ho Weidong is showing his fiancée their new apartment. And he says, this is our little nest. We will spend 100,000 yuan to renovate it properly. Xiaojia, his fiancée, says, we should buy a full set of home appliances, a VCD player, a 29-inch television set, an automatic washing machine, an air conditioner, and a complete set of wooden floors. And so the door to happiness opened. But then, thank you.